The following podcast is an Embassy Row production.
Hey, everybody, I'm Mark Lamont Hill. I am a professor, a scholar, and most importantly, a book nerd. I say book nerd because I don't just love to read books. I'm the person who loves to read about the book. I love hearing authors talk about how and why they wrote the book. And I love talking to other book nerds about their favorite books. That's why I started Coffee and Books. It's a podcast all about books. Every episode, I sit down over a cup of coffee with the world's biggest authors to discuss the most interesting, controversial, fun, and important books. Sometimes we hang out with experts, fans, and other special guests to talk about some of the greatest books of all time. And today, we are very, very lucky. We have an author, a Harvard University professor of English and African American Studies, a brilliant essayist, and his new book is called Who Will Pay Reparations on My Soul? We're joined by Jesse McCarthy. Jesse, good to see you.
Good to see you, man. Thank you so much for having me.
So first of all, before we even get to this amazing book you wrote, let's talk about the coffee part of coffee and books. I talk to authors. Almost everybody's a coffee drinker and they drink certain kinds. I personally today am just drinking a cup of plain black coffee that gets me through the day without too much of a charge. On a writing day, the coffee becomes espresso. And I do like an Americano, but today just plain black coffee for reading. That's my reading coffee. What's your situation like with the coffee?
Well, listen, man, I'll fully cop to being, a coffee addict. You know, I drink a lot of coffee, got to have it in the morning. And on intense writing days, I might extend into some espressos in the afternoon just to keep the momentum going. It depends. Sometimes I'll drink my coffee black. Although sometimes also I add a little milk in it because, like they say, it helps with the acidity. And since I do drink a lot of coffee, I'm mindful of, at some point the health impacts. So there's a little bit of that. But then, for a long time, what I would do is I would just go down to my local grocery store and get, I wasn't particularly like thoughtful, about the coffee that I bought. I would get like the whatever Starbucks coffee they had or Dunkin' Donuts or whatever.
You were drinking swill. How are you a highbrow cultural critic and you're drinking the swill?
Right. But then, right, like I evolved, right? And so I found just over the internet through some, people were telling me about it, this great company called Black and Bold. You should check them out. Black and Bold. They're Black owned. And part of their profits go to community impact. And, insofar as you're going to spend money on coffee anyway, why not spend it with a company where they have an explicit commitment, right, to investing in underinvested communities and making a social impact with their work and in supporting Black business. So plus it's a great name, Black and Bold, can't go wrong, BLK and Bold.
I love it.
And if I may say so, their coffee is excellent.
It's really good. Because that's the key, right? You can have all the social impact. You can be an important company, but it has to be good. It's like music, you can have righteous music that sucks, and that's the worst thing,
Absolutely, absolutely. and I'll confess, I was a little skeptical at first because I'm always a little skeptical about things, right? You always, I think, we live in a kind of an age like that. We're sort of reflectively, skeptical when people, even with the best intentions, tell you they're going to do this or that. But I got to tell you, man, like the way in which their product showed up, the quality of the product and the ease with which everything happened. Wow. No, I was sold. So I haven't looked back.
Cool, man. Well, that's great. Talk to me. Let's talk about this book. First of all, the title, Who Will Pay Reparations on My Soul? That's a provocative title. I was in Uncle Bobby's, my bookstore, and I can't tell you how many people were drawn to your book just from the title. Why the title?
So the title is, I'm borrowing the title from Gil Scott-Heron. Gil Scott-Heron is this, really kind of legendary figure. I think he's underknown in a certain extent, even though lots and lots of people, if they don't know his name, they'll know the phrase, the revolution will not be televised. And many folks, will recognize the song if they hear it. But, Gil Scott was in many ways a kind of a pioneer. Some people describe him kind of as the godfather of hip hop. He was connected in that whole kind of moment in the 70s. Really in the rise of kind of spoken word, in that scene with kind of the Lost Poets and these kinds of cats. And he has this very famous, one of his kind of iconic records. It was called Small Talk at 125th and Lenox, in reference to Harlem. And, you know, that's the album that has.
But that's also a great album.
Yeah, no, it's an incredible album. Incredible. The song Cool Hey Reparations on My Soul was one that, you know, I've been, you know, familiar with and listening to ever since, you know, I came across this record really, you know, as a teenager. And when I was trying to think about what really unified some of the preoccupations that I had in this book, you know, the book is, I would say, in a certain kind of way, about this kind of conjunction of the arts, cultural expression, poetry, music, literature, the world of, but also the world of ideas and politics. And Gil Scott-Heron was somebody who, you know, was kind of really well known for kind of positioning himself at this very intersection. He was always understood as a figure who was, you know, both an artist and, you know, a kind of creative and lyrical genius, but also somebody who was carrying a political message, you know, a kind of grassroots intellectual. And, you know, that to me was sort of at the core of the interests that I wanted to pursue in the book, this kind of interface in between culture, Black culture specifically, and the political, and also the world of ideas. And so it seemed to me a kind of fitting metaphor, a fitting riff. There's also the fact that, you know, it's a question. And that interrogative, that sense of an essay as a form which is not didactic. I'm not telling people what to think. I'm inviting them to ask deeper and, I hope, better questions about things that are, you know, of interest to us. That was also important to me. So, it resonated on a number of different levels, and I hope it works.
Oh, it absolutely works. Let's talk about some of those issues that come up, some of those themes that you talk about. I want to throw a few things out there. Obviously, you are a hip hop generation person, right? Or you grew up surrounded by hip hop, different generation than the one before you, but certainly hip hop is centered to how you understand or how you think about the world. That comes through in these essays a lot, whether it's conversations about trap music or whether it's talking about Jay-Z and Beyonce in France. Talk to me a little bit about the role that hip hop plays in these essays.
Well, you know, I really, you know, I'm born in 83. You know, I came up in the 90s and the early 2000s. And, you know, that just sort of meant by default that, you know, the music that I connected to and identified with was, you know, to some extent what we kind of look back on now, I think, to a certain extent, is kind of the, you know, the golden age of hip hop in a certain kind of way. And, you know, for me, there's this way in which, on the one hand, you know, hip hop was sort of like the leading edge of a certain form of popular Black expressiveness, right? In the same way that, you know, in kind of every historical epoch, you know, we see Black music in particular kind of fulfilling this kind of function, whether it be in funk in the 70s, you know, soul music, whether it be in R&B, whether it be in jazz, and of course the blues and gospel. And I think to a certain extent, you know, I've always felt that the music had a special relationship to a special way of communicating the current state of affairs in a certain kind of way of sort of American life in a really deep and broad way. Even though it's always kind of, you know, primarily identified with Black and in particular with African-American experience. But, you know, one of the things that was really interesting, right? And I wonder if you kind of had similar feelings about this, because, you know, you yourself are also, you know, a hip hop scholar, fantastic book on hip hop. And I'm also someone, right, who comes in the wake of a kind of entire generation. Also, not just the music, but thinking about the music and theorizing about the music, whether it be Prophets of the Hood. I mean, there's a whole literature on hip hop and thinking about it. But I also, you know, as I was kind of beginning to write for the public, beginning to do this kind of criticism, that was also a moment when the music was changing, right? In a way that was perceptible. And people began to talk about this thing that we call trap music. And part of me was curious about, okay, what's the difference? Like, what's different about what's going on now relative to what was going on when I was coming up in the 90s and early 2000s? So coming up in the 90s, you know, I was somebody who, you know, I was a fan of Nas, Jay-Z, of, you know, all kind of the greats of that era. And so I found myself having this kind of awkward situation where when the music started to change in kind of, I would say, you know, the mid 20 teens, if we want to call it that, and trap music became dominant, you know, Future became, you know, a huge superstar. I found myself in this position of awkwardly sounding like the people I didn't want to sound like, the people I used to make fun of. And sort of my parents' generation said, you know, oh, what is this? There's no lyrical subtlety like we had, you know, right. You know, it's this mumblecore, reaction to the music. And then that forced me to say, well, whoa, why let me not fall into that trap, right? Let me not just reflexively be this person who's kind of crotchety and judging this music. And let me actually try this, that it took me 2 years to write this essay, Notes on Trap. And I spent that time delving into kind of trying to critically think about the music, listen to the music, but also really learn as much as I could about, you know, this younger generation of artists that was making the music. And a lot of what happened was, you know, it was not that it necessarily moved me to sort of quote unquote, you know, endorse the music. It's not that I'm, you know, a cheerleader for trap music. There are all kinds of, you know, problematic quote unquote things about it or about the content or however you want to think about that. But I'm not interested in judging it. I'm interested in trying to think about, right, what it is trying to say and what that tells us about our world, right, and about our society. You know, I really came away from that listening changed, and it really changed how I regarded that music, and in a lot of ways also got me to appreciate it and to like it in new ways. And so, you know, this is the kind of thing where I'm really interested in trying to move away from some of the superficial ways we sometimes engage with these things and see if there are better questions we can ask of these things.
What makes for a better question?
So I think what makes for a better question is, first of all, being skeptical about whatever form you tend to hear the questions being posed in, right? In other words, you know, kind of taking ownership of the question and not simply regurgitating or repeating the way in which a question has come up in words that were sort of not your own, right? And so if typically, let's say in regards to questions about Black music or about trap music, oftentimes what you hear when you're in just, you know, in conversations, you know, around, you know, on the corner, anywhere, and people, you know, say, well, you know, it's bad. It hurts our, you know, it hurts our image, or it's crass, or it's immoral, to say, okay, well, that's one way of thinking about it, but how would I restate this for myself? And do I agree, you know, how can I rethink about some of the assumptions that go into that in the first place? So I think that's one way, is always to refuse to simply repeat questions as they come to us, but really to reframe them for ourselves, however you want to do that. And the second thing I would say about asking a better question is maybe two kind of components, right? One would be to try and take your personal sort of evaluative judgment out of it for a moment and try and think about it in a kind of disinterested way. So, you know, because we're trained in so many ways, because we live in a highly capitalistic culture, to immediately want to say, you know, do I like it? Do I dislike it? You know, do I want to buy more of it? Do I, you know, does it slap? Is it good? You know, is it good for the club? Okay, well, those are some ways to think about something. But if I step back from it and I try and ask just sort of like, how is this made? Right? Like what's its structure? Why is somebody making it? What are the, you know, regardless of whether I think it's good or bad, just why are they making this and not something else? I think that begins to move us in the direction that makes for a better question, because in a sense, you start to discover aspects of that thing that are actually affecting our judgment, but aren't things that we're not necessarily conscious of, right? That we're not articulating explicitly. And so I think that, you know, better questions tend to be those that to a certain extent kind of excavate all of the elements that are present in something. And we might even know them or feel them intuitively, but we haven't found language to describe them, to make them explicit. But that process of making something explicit, you know, that's not trivial, right? Like when you, that moment where you can start to apply language to something in a way where you can kind of get a hold on it. Part of what happens, right, is you're now changing the discourse, because those questions that were coming at you, the way something is received, now you have a way to start changing the way other people have that kind of first level reception when you put out a question that actually hits on a slightly deeper level.
You wrote a letter to D'Angelo, right? I mean, the chapter is both a kind of pieces of this open letter to D'Angelo.
Yeah.
And it's also a kind of reflection on what it means to write an open letter to D'Angelo and sort of the broader context in which he emerges. Why D'Angelo and why this form?
So one of the things I would say is that, you know, I think a lot about the essay, not just as a place where I want to kind of bring together different ideas and try and work through something I'm trying to figure out for myself. But I'm also really interested in, you know, kind of messing with the form. One of the things I'm interested in doing with essays is to, you know, kind of mess with the form. And, you know, to, I hope, invite especially sort of young writers and critics and, you know, people who are interested in writing and thinking about culture and ideas and music and art and all of these things, and saying there's not necessarily a right way and a wrong way of doing this. And there's a lot of value, I think, in kind of experimenting with new ways of writing about things. And also, I would argue, a kind of tradition of doing so. You know, when you think about, you know, a really iconic classic text like, you know, Du Bois's The Souls of Black Folk, from the perspective of genre and from the perspective of style, it's a really radical text. You know, she has to kind of discover a new way of writing. You know, when Baldwin writes his essays, it's not just that he's putting forward really important ideas, right? Part of the reason that his writing has had the kind of impact that it had in the moment and that it continues to have is because, in a certain sense, he invented a new kind of essay. He sort of crafted a new voice. He introduced a kind of flavor to it that it really didn't have before. You know, whether it was, you know, trying to figure out how to write about trap music, you know, I realized, oh, I can't just, you know, write this kind of traditional first person essay. It just wasn't working. I had to completely break open the form in order to figure out, to be honest, kind of a way of writing about it that wasn't going to actually kind of be corny, you know?
Yeah.
And I think with, you know, with D'Angelo, part of what's going on there is that, you know, I mean, as an artist, you know, his music was so, I think, so formative to me. You know, I mean, you know, Brown Sugar, you know, Voodoo. I mean, those albums to me were so formative, I think, in part, and this gets a little bit actually to that kind of hip hop generation thing, because I always felt like D'Angelo had this, you know, he was one of the few like really like R&B guys who was really doing, I mean, he was absolutely doing R&B, but there was this way in which, you know, you remember how hard, you know, that kind of the roughness, the griminess of that 90s hip hop was, you know. He had this, but he was accepted, you know, in a certain kind of way. Like people who were really hip hop heads, like everybody still loved D'Angelo. And he was kind of seen as in, you know, in a continuity with that. And there was something about the way in which he was able to bring kind of the hardness and the softness, the R&B and the hip hop sensibility in a kind of synthesis that, you know, that always really spoke to me, and that I've always found, you know, very moving. And when he came out with Black Messiah, and that piece, this piece sort of originated as kind of me wanting to write a review, basically, of that album.
Black Messiah, yeah.
Never got published, right? But I was thinking, you know, about that moment and the politics and the way that he was, you know, putting himself forward and making his artistry available to the needs of that moment. And again, you know, and this is sort of a theme throughout the book, I really do think that there's a way in which there's this a kind of salve, a kind of power of both synthesis in the sense of bringing together and bringing forward ideas about how we could live, what it would mean to have a life in this country, in the Americas, that was beautiful, that worked, that a project that people could come together around that would feel right. You know, I think somebody like D'Angelo, I think there's a way of listening to his music where that's at least one of the things that you hear in it, right? Not that his music is sort of, you know, quote unquote, crudely political, but I think it actually, or at least in that piece, one of the things I'm suggesting is that it actually does have this kind of, I hear in its sound, a kind of utopian quality, right? A kind of vision of the world we'd like to live in. And that when we come together, for example, you know, at a party, at a block party, you know, at a cookout, hopefully we can do that again this summer, and you know, and put on that music and we can be together, there's a way in which we're kind of in miniature form, you know, putting that into practice. And I think that's extraordinarily important. And to a certain extent, I felt like the letter, the form of the open letter is about trying to acknowledge the intimacy of that gesture. And intimacy is such a, I think, an important quality of his music. But the open letter, right, is both an attempt to make an intimate appeal, but one that's also collective and open and public. And that, I think, is part of the genius of his sound and of his music, that it's able to convey this extraordinary intimacy, but at the same time, it has this largeness of spirit, this kind of collective feeling, and that's kind of the public or the open side of it. And so that was, again, you know, kind of, I don't know if it worked, but it was this way of me trying to think about what's the form, what's the kind of written form that matches how I think about what this sound does, what this artist does with his music.
Talk to me just a little bit more about the broader project of the essay in a book or collection of essays. As an intellectual, as someone navigating a university where you have to write research books of some sort, university press books, you know, usually to get tenure, why at this stage in your career did you decide to accumulate these essays that you've been writing since 2014? Why did you decide that this was the best sort of form or the best way to introduce your ideas to the world, to the public?
I should say probably, you know, for clarity's sake, right, in terms of my scholarship, I'm primarily, you know, a literary scholar and someone who works on literary history. And, you know, in graduate school and in the work that I'm still doing now, you know, I was mostly interested in focusing on basically sort of problems that I saw or questions that I had about the relationship between politics and aesthetics in Black literature, and in particular, in a given historical moment that I generally refer to as kind of the early Cold War, this moment between the end of World War II in 1945 and 1965. There's this 20-year span in between the end of that war and the assassination of Malcolm X in 1965, which is really kind of the event and the moment that kind of changes the discourse, really. And when we see the rise of Black power and, you know, kind of insurgent Black militancy that is accompanied in turn on the aesthetic side, right, by the rise of the Black arts movement. But there's that moment in between that's kind of ill-defined. And I'm really interested in, you know, what's going on in the literature of that era. And, you know, if in order to write a really good scholarly book that will make sense of that period and address those questions in the kinds of ways that I want to, I have to do, you know, that work of scholarship. I have to, you know, go into the archives. I have to do work through, you know, very large bodies of secondary literature. And I'm in conversation with primarily other scholars, right? I'm in conversation with a long line of eminent scholars who have thought long and hard about you know, literary history as such, and of course about the tradition of, you know, African-American literature in particular. And when you write that kind of a book, necessarily it's not going to be a book that can address itself to a kind of general audience. You hope that it, you know, and I try even in my scholarly writing to not, you know, not be too jargony or anything like that. I prize a certain kind of clarity, of course, but necessarily it's a specialized endeavor. You know, I'm someone though who has always felt that I do identify as a scholar. I also identify as, you know, I would just say as a writer. And I think as a Black writer, especially, I've always felt that, you know, my writing has, I see myself and I understand myself as coming within a tradition. And that means that I think about what that tradition, in a certain sense, I think requires of me, if I can put it that way. And that to me means thinking about how am I making all of the incredible privilege that I've had to do all of this studying, right? To spend years of my life in the library, reading all these books, having access to all of this knowledge. If I'm hoarding all of that knowledge for myself and then only sharing it, let's say, with a scholarly audience,
yeah, you know,
that feels insufficient to me in terms of my responsibilities, as I understand it, to the tradition. And so the essay to me is this form that I think, you know, again, has often been used as a way for, you know, intellectuals and Black intellectuals, right, to say, okay, yeah, you know, I have this. This is where I stand professionally, and I take pride in the scholarly work that I'm doing. But the essay allows me, in a certain sense, to, in this kind of amphibious way, you know, step out a little bit and write something that will speak to a wider audience and hopefully circulate in a much wider way. And that circulation is meaningful to me. It's not, I should make clear, you know, it's not for me just about imposing my ideas or getting my ideas out to a wider world. In a sense, I'm interested in also, right, circulating all the ideas that I'm exposed to because I have the opportunities, right, of being a scholar, but that many other people don't necessarily have, but that I can give a kind of, I can amplify, right? And I can give a kind of wider circulation to. And so that to me is something that I've always really valued, that I, you know, think of as a kind of core aspect of what I do.
Who are some essayists that you think do that well? We're able to hit those notes, access those people, draw from those registers, make things plain, but offer also a kind of complicated, nuanced, and indeed counterintuitive sort of read of the world?
It's a great question. I feel like I'm going to get in trouble here because I'm going to leave people out. One thing I will say is when I think about, you know, the kind of work that Imani Perry does, when I think about the kind of work that Ta-Nehisi Coates has done, right? I mean, even just on the question, you know, of reparations. And, you know, it's interesting because obviously, to a certain extent, my own work, you know, appears as a kind of, you know, criticism of his work. But
a relatively gentle one, though, I mean, relative to what others have done, I would argue.
Absolutely. But you know, but one of the things I'm often at pains to point out is that, like, I'm enormously grateful for the fact that he not only did that work, but was able to do it in such a way that it got the kind of attention that it did, because that attention matters. Then people can come along, right, and, you know, say, well, I quibble with this and I don't, you know, I disagree with that. But the fact that he was able to actually put it on the table in a certain kind of way and make it an issue, force the issue in a certain kind of way, that's incredibly important. And it takes a certain kind of genius and a certain kind of talent to be able to make that happen. And it's important not to take away from that. What I think is then, you know, hopefully that's not an end point though, right? That should engender even more conversation. And there should be all kinds of people, not just me, but many others who come along and say, I want to extend the conversation in this direction or that direction because I disagree with this part or I disagree with that part. And that's a good thing, right? Like that's what we want. That's what we should want of our culture, right? That we have this really vibrant world where we're having serious, really well-informed conversations about things that are incredibly important to the future of our politics and to the state of our self-understanding.
I'm going to ask you a little bit about process, because one of the things that I find really interesting about your writing is how you reflect on your writing. You talk about returning to essays. You talk about working on things for 2 years. You talk about writing individual pieces, not necessarily with the goal of producing this project at the time that you start writing in 2014 and 2016. Sometimes you're writing to make sense of the world. Sometimes you're writing using writing as a method of inquiry. I mean, even in the book, you talk about the process of the letter, and you compare it to Baldwin, not yourself to Baldwin, but you sort of draw on Baldwin's essays as a way of saying that sometimes what's on the page itself becomes its own inquiry. I mean, this is fascinating to me, but it makes me wonder how you think about writing as a process. What does your writing process look like? Well, actually, let me ask a meta question first, since that's the kind of mode we're in. Sort of, How do you think about, before I get into the kind of specifics of your process, what does writing process mean to you? And what is the importance of thinking about process?
For me, the process of writing always begins in reading. To me, there's no real secret, you know, there's no secret sauce in that sense, right? Like from my point of view, it's like, and I think it's pretty, you know, pretty evident in the essays themselves that, you know, I'm someone who does a lot of reading. And I say that not to not like to brag and boast, but actually, because to me, it's actually, I feel, you know, to me, it should be a kind of, we should think of it as a certain kind of humility, right? That is to say that every time I even sit down to think about, you know, writing something, part of the thing that I'm also thinking about is the fact that so many other people have already written about this. So many other people have, you know, written about this extremely well. And, you know, what can I possibly hope to add? And also, what is possible? You know, you don't know, part of why you read is not just to kind of acquire, quote, in that crude word that we use these days, content, but to know how it's possible to write about things. And so the first part of my process is always doing reading and then more reading and more reading and more reading before, you know, writing can ever begin. And then in terms of, you know, the process of writing itself, you know, the one thing for me is that it's a very slow, somewhat painful process, but I'm someone who is very exacting and very demanding at the level of the sentence. And so I feel
you're one of those. Let me pause you there because this is an interesting thing, right? I happen to talk to writers every week and some people bang out drafts quickly and then their entire journey is the edit. And for them, it's important to whatever this thing is in their brain, they need to get it out as quickly as possible. And then they can sort out the form, they can sort out the quality, they can sort out the style, they can clean it up, all that stuff. Then there are people who have this big idea in their head, but they actually can't fully get it out. I'm one of those people. That's why I'm drilling down here. There's an essay I've been writing since 2009. And it's not like, it's not worthy of 12 years of writing. I promise you it's not. But there are moments where I write it and I feel really good about it. There are moments where, you know, I think if you mentioned Imani Perry, I think I sent Imani the first draft of it. She's like, oh, this is brilliant. This is wonderful. This is beautiful, you know. And then, which only terrified me even more because I'm like, now everything, the next sentence has to be that too. But I can't write sentence two until I feel like sentence one is as perfect as possible. I can't write paragraph two unless paragraph one to me is something that I feel like the world is ready to read. And that freezes me as a writer at times. And so edits are never a problem. Every editor I've ever worked with is like, yo, by the time you send us a draft, it's damn near like ready for copy edit. But why do you take 3 extra years to send us the draft? You know, tell me a little bit more about what it means for you to be that exacting at the level of the sentence, why you think it's that way. And what do you think of as the affordances and the constraints of that approach?
One of the risks that you're speaking to, right, is, and, you know, I think most writers encounter this a good deal. You know, one of the risks is a kind of paralysis. You get so caught up in your own anxiety that you kind of lose track of the impulse. You lose your rhythm. You know, I'm somebody who thinks a lot about writing in terms of rhythm. And so for me, yes, I am super exacting about it, but I tend to write, you know, typically in kind of spurts, I would say, you know, or segments, you know. It's kind of like, you know, either it's hot, you know, I can be hot for a minute, you know, it's like when you're playing, you know, like a ball player, like sometimes you just go cold, right?
Right.
And then sometimes the player will heat up and then when they're hot, you just pass them the ball, right? You know, Steph is shooting them three, just keep feeding him the ball. You know what I mean? So when it's hot, I just keep going. And if it needs to be edited, okay, we'll do that later. But, you know, I can feel that it's in rhythm. And that for me is the thing, because to me, you know, there is that quality of breath and voice and all of that. And a lot of this also, right, you know, I think, you know, I'm interested in a certain kind of way in a writing style that I hope will be, you know, to a certain extent personal. And, you know, I always say, you know, I get this actually, you know, from Fred Moten, who's a, you know, a philosopher and a writer and a poet, theorist who I greatly admire, you know, but he always said, I wanted my writing to have a sound, a really recognizable sound. In the way that, like, you hear, a few bars of Miles Davis and you know it's Miles.
Like, you know it's Miles.
You know immediately, right? It could not possibly be anybody else. You know, I think of this also to a certain extent in terms of tradition, right? I think Black writers in particular, because we kind of have this kind of, interesting kind of counter relation, this kind of counter hegemonic positioning relative to the dominant traditions that we work within. That's also kind of important to me, right? Like I want to mess around a little bit. I don't want it to be corny. I don't want it to be the way everybody else has done it. But at the same time, at a minimum, it needs to sound right to me. That's where that exactingness comes in. There is that risk of paralysis. And that's why, for me at least, it's, I try to not get too caught up in, refusing to allow myself to move to the next sentence or the next sentence, but I will throw out pages. I'll cut, the whole damn thing and start over if need be. But
wow.
But that takes a certain kind of discipline. Well, discipline, I think discipline is everything, right? Because in a certain sense, it's also about, this is something I say, not to be too apocalyptic about these things, right? But, we live in a time where, we have a greater, kind of, I hope we have, a kind of greater ecological consciousness, right? And I think about this, man, this book came in the mail and, how many books have you put out now?
I think
half a dozen, right?
Yeah. Somehow.
so maybe it's distant to you now, but I'm sure that first time, right? That first book, when it comes in the mail, you actually see it. It's this incredible feeling to kind of hold the
physical. It never changes. That never changes.
But, I'm also, holding it and I'm like, this is heavy, man. Like this is a, this is a couple of trees, right? Like, right. So am I worthy of that? Right. Like, am I wasting, these resources? Like, if I'm making people, and also like your time, what I'm saying? Like you took time. I'm saying you personally, Mark, took time out of your life to read my work, to read my book, right? Am I worthy of that? Because if I'm not putting, a serious amount of effort into it, why should you put that effort into reading it, right? So I feel like I need to be worthy of that. I need to be, conscious of the fact that like, I'm imposing and demanding that resources be allocated, to my writing. Is my writing deserving of that? I think it needs to be. So I need to feel like I've justified that to myself. And so that to me, that's where that discipline comes in, right? Like I have to really believe that this book needed to exist, right? It's not just like, oh, I wanted to do something or, why not? No. I have to be able to justify to myself that this, this needed to exist in the world and it's worth the cost in a certain kind of sense, the cost to people in terms of attention, in terms of their time, the cost in terms of the resources it takes for people to produce the book. I have to be worthy of that. And so that I think, to me is one of the ways in which discipline comes into it.
Do you write every day?
I should write every day. I'm going to say it like this. There are very few days I would say that go by where I don't write something. There are many days that go by where I feel like I haven't written anything that I really like or that's, genuinely productive, but I do write most days. There are most days of the week I'll get some kind of writing done, but I'm not going to lie. I have, my off days where for whatever reason, it's just not right. And typically, to be honest with you, that's a day when if it's really like that, I'm somebody who, writing is at the core and the center of my life, right? It's what I, and writing that, by the way, right? Like I said, writing is always also reading. So when I say writing, I'm also always reading, right? But it's not the only thing, that I do. Like, I love basketball, I love music. And so on a day, if I'm having a bad writing day and I can feel that, I listen to records, man. I'm the type of dude, I'll put on a record and listen to a whole record. I love to listen to music. And if it's not a good writing day, maybe it's a day for taking in some music. Maybe it's a day for, trying to, go learn about something I don't know about or discover some art or maybe, you know, just go outside, you know, and just like soak up some sun, you know, or watch a basketball game, you know what I mean? And just like being, you know, be in touch with that for a minute. So I don't force it. Again, it's about rhythm. I don't want to lose the rhythm of writing. And so I need to, you know, I would say almost every day though, you know, I do eventually get to some writing.
That's important. I try that. Every day I wish I had written. That's the best I can offer. Some days some days it just doesn't work for me. Some days life gets in the way, as you know, as I've gotten older, life sometimes just gets in the way. And the worst feeling is when you're motivated to write and can't, and then the next day you have plenty of time and opportunity, and the spirit ain't moving you. So before we go, there is a game that I like to play with all of my guests. I don't want you to worry, because this game brings me great joy, although it often tortures the guests. That's the best part. The game is called Buy It, Borrow It, or Burn It. I'm going to give you three books. One you can buy, one you can borrow, one you got to burn. And not only will you tell me which one, but you should tell me why. You should give us, you know, the audience a sense of why. Book number one, Playing in the Dark, Whiteness in the Literary Imagination by Toni Morrison. Book number two, In the Break, The Aesthetics of the Black Radical Tradition. And book number three, just to make it easier, David Walker's Appeal. When you buy, when you borrow, when you burn.
Listen, Mark, the first thing I'm going to say here is that I am categorically opposed to the burning of books.
Yes, as we all are. As a bookstore owner, as a proponent of free speech, as a lover of books, I agree.
I kind of do not endorse this on that. And of the three books that you mentioned, none of those books can be burned. You're asking me the impossible right now. Okay.
Oh, this is bringing me joy already.
So I think with Walker's Appeal, you should borrow it. You know, Walker's Appeal is a text. Well, first of all, it's, you know, it's a public domain text.
Yeah.
And it's a text that we need to be more familiar with. I know you're familiar with it. I know those of us who are in Black studies, those of us who are interested in Black intellectual history, in American history more generally, are familiar with Walker and his appeal. But it's a text that I really wish circulated more widely. And you know, as you know, that I try to bring some attention to in my own work. So I'm going to say borrow, because, you know, you can go get it. And, you know, at your local library, wherever you're at, go get that book. Plunge into Walker's Appeal, because, you know, in terms of thinking about, as I conceive of it, a kind of a really foundational text to thinking about the place of Black folk in American life and the kinds of claims that we make upon national destiny, there's so much there that we are still grappling with, and that I think we really need to come back to and think really carefully about. In terms of buy, I'm going to say the Morrison, Playing in the Dark. You know, that's money that'll go to her, you know, her estate, and I think that's fine. So go buy that book. That book is probably, you know, one of the most significant works of literary criticism, you know, the last whatever it is now, you know, 30, 40 years.
Absolutely. Imagine that. Can we just put an asterisk? I mean, imagine being maybe the greatest writer America's ever produced, right? I mean, you've written The Bluest Eye, you've written Songs of Solomon, you've written Beloved. I mean, imagine having that. And then also to write one of the great works of literary criticism, you know, in the last generation. I mean,
And here's the thing. That book, you know, and this is so true of Morrison, right? Is she's so economical and so precise and so forceful in her writing. That's not a long book, right? She didn't have to write like a massive tome. She took care of like the whole thing.
Right, in a hot 16.
Like a couple hundred, it's less, maybe 120 some odd pages, something like that. It's incredible. It's an absolutely incredible feat. And, you know, that is one of the things, by the way, that, you know, I also pointed out in, you know, my essay. By the way, this is not at all an original point that I'm making. I'm hardly the first person to make it. I'm just adding to the chorus here. But I do think it's important for people to recognize and grapple with the fact that Morrison was not only, you know, our preeminent novelist, but an extraordinary intellectual, right? And someone who was bringing a set of ideas to the study of literature, and also really, you know, in really thinking very, very carefully and really forceful and important ways within the tradition about, you know, social questions, political questions, feminism, all of these things. She has extraordinary contributions that we really should attend to. So buy that book. So now you've left me in the absolutely terrible position, which I think is of saying that you should that I'm calling for the burning of Fred Moten's extraordinary book in the break. But you know, the reason that I've set it up this way is that I think maybe even Moten himself would see that perhaps that book, if by burning it if you have to read it first before you burn it, there's a way in which that kind of almost transmutation of the substance of that book into ash and into something that can live outside of the written page, I think he wouldn't even be to a certain extent against that, because I think one of the great strengths of his vision and of the way that he thinks about these things is that he's so attuned to the ways in which some of the key aspects of knowledge transmission, knowledge creation, you know, and aesthetic appreciation that are essential to us and that make our culture so vibrant and potent exist beyond the page and do not require and have never required a literary transmission as such, that have always happened traditionally in Black culture, in music, in the oral tradition, in the spoken word, in preaching, in the way in which we practice our aesthetics through a particular form of what Moten would call sociality, right? A way of being together that we practice in the way, even in the way we hang out. And so to a certain extent, his ideas will survive the burning of the book and do not require the printed page. If you sit down and just listen to Moten speak to you for a while about pretty much any topic under the sun,
literally
any topic, you will come away from that experience informed and enriched. And so that's why, much as I am absolutely against book burning, I think that book in particular would in a sense survive. So you gave me an impossible task.
Yes.
But you see how I tried to swerve here. And
I saw how you maneuvered it, man. You went left and right, man. Exactly, man. That's very hip hop of you. I love it. I love it. I love it, man. Well, look, thank you for hanging out with me today. Thank you for doing Coffee and Books. Everybody. No, man, it's honestly a pleasure. And it is a privilege to have read your work and to watch as you become just one of the most prominent writers and essayists of this generation, man. I'm so excited for you. And I'm so proud of your work, man. The book is called Who Will Pay Reparations on My Soul. You can get it anywhere books are sold. But of course, you can always get it at Uncle Bobby's, as you can all the books that we've talked about today, including the work of Toni Morrison, including the work of Fred Moten, and including the work of David Walker. How can people get a hold of you? If people want to get a hold of you, do you do social media?
I am on social media. I'm on
Twitter,
but to be honest, I'm sort of on social media, but I'm not a prolific social media user. I don't use it very well, but my Twitter handle is at Jesse D McCart. It cuts off my last name, but MCCART. So cool. At Jesse D McCart, or, you know, my email is on is on the Harvard website, you know, and, you know, people be surprised. I mean, obviously I get lots of weird email all the time. I can't answer everything, but I do answer a lot of emails from random people, because I love talking to people wherever they're at in the world. And, you know, like I said, I'm interested in being in conversation, not just with the Academy, but with people everywhere. You know, well, and it's everyday people.
Well, that's how you do it, man. Y'all can hit them on the Harvard website. You can hit them on Twitter, although you may not be quite as lucky there. But make sure, most importantly, read the book. His best ideas are in his writing, and there's so many of them. Jesse, thanks for hanging out with me, man.
Thank you, Mark. I really appreciate it.
Coffee and Books is a production of Embassy Row. Our executive producer is Sarnie Rogers. This episode was produced by Karis Nelson. The show was edited by Maureen Bigas. And you can follow me on Instagram at Mark Lamont Hill and the show on Instagram at Coffee and Books Show. Catch you next week.